I don't know whether you've ever noticed this, but Jesus was not very picky about the people he ate with. In the particular account which Ab and Amy just read to us, I think it would be fair to say that the Pharisees who were gathered were scandalized that Jesus would eat with notoriously disreputable people. As for the notoriously disreputable, they were probably a little bit put off and a little bit confused that Jesus seemed altogether willing to eat with those who were part of the phony religious establishment. And so in this passage, what we see once again is one of these wonderful, dynamic bringing together of cultures, which Jesus, especially in the Gospel of Luke, loves to surprise us with. Remember what I've been telling you for several weeks, that in the Gospel of Luke, we see Jesus full of surprises. And we see the gospel of the kingdom, which is a gospel of surprise. Now, that's not surprise in some serendipity sense, the way we often mean it today. But rather, Jesus is pleased to surprise us with the truth of the kingdom and to bring that truth home to our hearts in ways that sometimes we least expect, or where there's a twist that's unexpected. Look for the surprise in any passage in the Gospel of Luke, and there I would propose to you, you will find the deepest meaning of that passage. So look here at this encounter that gets created between this notoriously wicked woman, on the one hand, and Simon and his fellow Pharisees, on the other. That's the grit in which Jesus does some extremely important teaching. Now, in this particular passage, Jesus comes to the home of Simon, one of the Pharisees, for dinner. He's asked there by Simon. Now, as the Pharisees were generally hostile to Jesus, it was perhaps a little risky for him to accept the invitation. But apparently, there was nothing particularly sinister in Simon's motives for inviting Jesus home that evening. Perhaps he was just curious. He had heard about Jesus Christ, hadn't he? The town in which this probably took place, the town that's alluded to in verse 37, but not named specifically, is almost certainly the town of Capernaum. And in that town, if you remember, just from what's happened in the Gospel of Luke so far, amazing things have gone on. There in that town, Jesus had healed people who were so sick that it was sure that they were going to die, including Peter's mother-in-law. Just offshore outside of Capernaum, Jesus had performed this incredible miracle where it seemed like every fish in the Sea of Galilee at his command jumped into the nets of Peter the fisherman. So Simon, if indeed this was Capernaum, was probably curious. Who is this one who does these things? And so he decides to invite him home. Maybe he thought he was a prophet. Maybe he wanted, like Nicodemus, to have an interview with him. In any event, it's clear that the Pharisees were not very friendly. And in fact, Simon wasn't very friendly to Jesus at all, because it was the common courtesy of the day that when you had a visitor come to your home, you would provide for them a little oil, a little olive oil, when they first got there, in order for them to freshen up. It would be much like you wouldn't ask somebody if they would like to go to the washroom if they arrived at your home, especially if they'd been traveling for a while to get there, to freshen up before the meal. Well, apparently, according to this passage, that common courtesy was not afforded to Jesus from Simon the Pharisee. A woman comes into the dining room. Verse 37 literally begins, in the language in which this text was originally written, it literally begins, "and behold." In other words, it indicates that her presence was a bit startling. And the reason that it was startling was readily apparent to all. This woman was known in the city as a woman of bad character. That's a nice way to put it. Almost certainly she was a prostitute. Apparently this is not the first time that she had seen Jesus. Perhaps she had seen him preach from Peter's boat when, after the catch of fish, the people had gathered around to want to hear Jesus teach. Perhaps she herself had made her services available to Peter or some of his companions in the fishing industry. All that is quite likely. But now she herself, perhaps because of their witness, perhaps because of the convincing power of Christ's presence and his words, She too has had a real change in her life. Yet her change is undoubtedly quite recent because her reputation publicly has not yet caught up with her changed lifestyle, and she's still perceived as being quite immoral. Now, if you think about it, I hope you are, doesn't it seem a little odd to you that this woman just walks in the dining room? I mean, can you imagine if you're having a dinner party in your home and somebody you didn't invite, particularly somebody who was not of such good character in community, just sort of wandered in? Well, that was interesting in this time. It would have been demonstrated that the woman had a lot of courage, but actually it was not impolite. Courage because of what was likely to happen to her in the presence of the Pharisees. They might be stunned by her presence, scorn her publicly, even plan to stone her. But it wasn't impolite, because in Israel it was not uncommon for all kinds of people to come to the door of the prominent, especially when they were giving big dinner parties. And somehow it was the custom of the day. I know it sounds unusual, but it would be the custom of the day for people to gather around the outside of the dining room. Maybe some of them would wait for the guests to throw them scraps of food. Maybe some would just enjoy listening to the conversation and get engaged in the dialogue that would go on at the dinner table. In any event, this is apparently what this woman was doing. But what is very remarkable is the immediate effect that the presence of Jesus has on this woman. Sandals would be removed while you sat down at the table. You would probably do what they called reclining at table, which meant you would sort of be half lying down on cushions with probably one elbow propped up on the table as you would eat. Very impolite way of eating, right? But that's the way they would do it. So it would not have been hard for the woman to have had access to Jesus' feet. And apparently that is what she intended to come to do, was to use the perfume that she had brought to pour as a kind of indication of her worship of him on his feet. But what she had not planned was that in the presence of Jesus, she would begin to weep uncontrollably. And when the tears fell on Jesus' feet, she was perhaps surprised and afraid to call attention to herself. Maybe she even thought that as a wicked woman, her tears would defile the Lord. And so she begins to take her hair and wipe his feet with her hair, which necessitated that she had to let down her hair, which would have been a disgrace in her culture, a disgrace that she ignored in the grip of her deep emotion. When she saw that Jesus did not recoil from her touch, as any man in Capernaum would publicly, at least, recoil from the touch of this woman, she added to her expression of love and worship, kissing his feet. And this would be a mark of deep respect, especially for rabbis. And finally, instead of using the perfume that she had brought to perhaps put on his head, which would be the more appropriate place for perfume rather than oil, she compensates for Simon's lack of providing the common courtesies by taking her perfume and pouring it on his feet to clean them. Now, there are at least three things that you must notice about this passage. There's undoubtedly many more, but there's at least three that are worthy of our notice about the interaction between Simon, the woman, and Jesus. The first is that this woman has no illusions about who she is. The whole scene is one of the most dramatic and beautiful scenes in the gospel. I would love to see it portrayed visually and dramatically sometime. It's full of profound contrast, the cool aloofness of Simon, the unabashed, lavish worship of the woman. In contrast to Simon, she's not smug in her religious status. She has no religious status. After all, everyone knew who she was. She was a prostitute. She had no status. Some of us went the other night to the Voice of Hope banquet, celebrating 10 years of Voice of Hope's ministry in the city of Dallas. One of the most remarkable things about that event to me was the testimonies of some of the people who had been affected by Voice of Hope's ministry. And one of the most remarkable things about their testimonies is as they stood up, They were standing before us as people who really knew, had no illusions about who they were. They knew who they were. They knew they were people who were hurting. And they knew that the grace of Christ had touched their lives. Well, at least I'm not as bad as this woman, you can imagine Simon saying, in his smugness, in his religiosity. This is precisely, in fact, what he did say. Don't you know what kind of woman this is who's touching you? We so often compare ourselves to our image of other people's wrongs. We so often compare ourselves to other people and we sort of establish a non-verbal, non-spoken, under-the-surface sort of spiritual pecking order in which we decide rather arbitrarily that those other people, whoever they are, they're fairly wicked folks, you know? I mean, they do bad things. Me, on the other hand, I'm not such a bad fellow, or I'm not such a bad girl. And in doing that, what we say is that we really do have illusions about ourselves. Simon constructed skyscrapers of illusion about his own status before God. Think of the way this woman would have read David's Psalm of Forgiveness, his great psalm where in Psalm 51, he cries out to God for forgiveness. For I know my transgressions. My sin is always before me. Can you imagine Simon the Pharisee saying that? Simon, if he ever thought about his sin at all, he probably took comfort in it in respect to Psalm 51. He probably said, well, I'm not as bad as David. David really did some bad things, didn't he? Deceit, adultery, treachery, murder. Bad fellow, that David. But the woman didn't look at David. She didn't look at Simon. She didn't look at anybody except Jesus. Against God and God alone have I sinned, David said, and she would have echoed. And so she could agonize with David. Against God and God alone have I sinned. O Lord, cleanse me. The genius, you see, of this woman, like David, is that she has no pretensions about who she is. One time, several years ago, I was asked to list 10 books I wish my congregation would read. I listed those 10 books, and the interesting thing about them is only one out of the 10 was written by an author who was still alive, which is my way of frankly telling you that most Christian books today aren't worth reading. And really, if you want to go for the good stuff, go for the old stuff, because it's tried and true. There is an exception to that. It's a book that's just come out. And at great risk of who knows what, I'm going to tell you about this book, and I'm about ready to read an excerpt from it. Charles Colson has written a book called The Body. It is saying everything I ever dreamed of saying about the church, and a whole lot more. And I do commend this book to you. At one point in the book, he talks about religious smugness and pretension, and he uses an example from his own experience. I don't think you should read a whole lot in sermons, but I'm going to take just a minute and read this excerpt. He's speaking about the fact that we must speak the message boldly, the message of the gospel boldly and with love, and God surprises us, he says sometimes, when we do that. As he discovered several years ago, he says, when I met with a prominent business leader in a southeastern city. Mr. Abercrombie, as we shall call him, was not only a pillar of the community and an active church member, but he also hosted a weekly Bible study luncheon in his office. Since I was in the city to speak at the governor's prayer breakfast, Mr. Abercrombie invited me to attend the study luncheon. 19 men in all, dressed in dark suits, conservative ties, and white shirts, filled in at the appointed hour. They filled the large conference room, which was paneled on one side in beautiful rosewood, and on the other side with plate glass windows offering a breathtaking view of the city that these men ran and owned. Although this was the city's power establishment, each man showed deference to our host, who had recently been featured in a national magazine as one of the up-and-comers of the corporate world. Mr. Abercrombie had asked me to speak at the luncheon and then allow time for questions. Somewhere in my talk, I referred to our sinful nature. Actually, I used the term total depravity. I noticed at the time that a few individuals shifted uncomfortably in their leather chairs, and sure enough, it must have hit the mark, because after I finished, the first question was on sin. You don't really believe we're sinners, do you? I mean, you are too sophisticated, one of the men said, to be one of those hellfire and brimstone fellows. He eyed my dark pinstripe suit and assumed I was one of them. Intelligent people don't just go for that backcountry preaching stuff, he added. Yes, sir, I replied. I believe we are desperately sinful. What's inside of each of us is really pretty ugly. In fact, we deserve hell and would get it except for the sacrifice of Christ for our sins. Mr. Abercrombie himself looked distressed by now. Well, I don't know about that, he said. I am a good person, and I have been all my life. I go to church, and I get exhausted spending all my time doing good works. The room seemed particularly quiet, and 20 pairs of eyes were trained on me. If you believe that, Mr. Abercrombie, and I hate to say this, for you certainly won't invite me back, you are, for all the good of your works, further away from the kingdom than the people I work with in prison who are aware of their own sins. Someone at the other end of the table coughed. Another rattled his coffee cup, and a flush quickly worked its way up from beneath Mr. Abercrombie's starched white collar. In fact, gentlemen, I added, if you think about it, we're all really more like Adolf Hitler than we are like Jesus Christ. Now there was stony silence. Until someone eased the pain and changed the subject. When lunch ended and I was prepared to leave, Mr. Abercrombie took my arm. Didn't you say you wanted to make a phone call when we were finished? He said. I started to say it wasn't necessary, and then I realized he wanted to talk to me alone. Yes, thank you, I said. He led me down the corridor to an empty office. As soon as we were inside, he said bluntly, I don't have what you have. I know, I replied, but you can. God is touching your heart right now. No, he took a step back. Maybe sometime later. I pressed a bit more, however, and moments later, we were both on our knees, Mr. Abercrombie asking forgiveness of his sins and turning his life over to Christ. Brothers and sisters, we must be very careful about our smugness. We must never assume that anything that we have or are somehow makes us okay with God. That was Simon's great fault. And that's why Jesus received the worship of the woman. She came with no smugness, no illusions about her identity. Nothing she could bring, nothing in the world's eyes that made her acceptable. The danger for people who are in the world's eyes are more than acceptable is that we will not realize how desperately we need what only Christ can give. And there needs to be about our Christian lives a little bit of desperation. For the Christian, you know, all true growth is in the direction of humility. I am not what I seem to be to others. I am not what I want myself to think I am. And with David, I should say, in my innermost being, there is no truth. We pretend that it, whatever it is in your life, really isn't so bad. We comfort ourselves that it really is a small thing. We tell ourselves that the bad is outweighed by the good, and besides, we say, nobody's perfect. And we excuse ourselves by saying that God probably doesn't even notice. May I just tell you, on the basis of the authority of the Holy Scripture, and on the basis of the character of God who is all-knowing and ever-present, that He notices? He notices it all. And part of our own blindness about ourselves is that we think God is as blind as we are. And brothers and sisters, we are fools for being so comforted. And so the real question, you see, is what made this woman see herself accurately? What made her so honest? What helped her put away her illusions? And that leads us to the second thing that we need to see about this woman. Now just relax. We're going to go over time. This is important. I really believe with all my heart this is important. So just relax, okay? She put away her illusions when she saw herself accepted by Jesus. What compelled her to weep was seeing that the forgiveness Jesus gave her was greater than all her sins. Perhaps she came to Simon's house just to be near Jesus. And when she got near there and she saw that he didn't gasp as most men would in her presence, when he did not recoil from her in public, she found in his acceptance nothing short of the acceptance of God. It is the love, the grace, the acceptance of Jesus that shattered her illusions about herself, cut her to the honest quick, melted her resistance. And so she could say with David, "Have mercy on me according to your unfailing love, according to the greatness of your compassion." The greatness of your compassion. Blot out my transgressions. The loving grace of Christ overwhelmed her. And so she could learn with David that the sacrifices of God are a broken and contrite heart. That is what God wants. He wants broken hearts. He wants people who say, "I have failed. I can't live the way I'm supposed to live. I can't do it on my own." He needs people who say that they are prepared to be overwhelmed by the loving acceptance of Jesus. What makes you and me face ourselves? Is it when someone tells us how wrong we are? Is it when they shake their finger at us? Is it the pronouncement of our sin in the law? No, that's what Simon did to the woman. Everyone knows what kind of woman you are. The law doesn't make us face ourselves. The law tells us what's wrong with us, and therefore it plays a very important part. But it doesn't make us face ourselves. What compels our honesty is grace. It's the white, hot, holy heat of the acceptance of Jesus. His loving forgiveness is what draws me to see that I'm full of illusions about myself. I grew up near a pond called Gorham's Pond in Connecticut. Every winter, the pond would freeze over, several feet thick of ice, and the kids of the community would all go skating on the pond. This pond always reminds me of how thick ice can get. You know, I've thought of something as I was trying to think of what it's like to understand the white-hot heat of the loving acceptance of Jesus melting our hearts. Imagine if I went out on Gorham's Pond in the middle of February and I took a shovel or an axe and I tried to dig up the ice. That's what the law does to us. It comes and it beats against us and tells us how bad we are. Yes, the law is a mirror, and yes, we need the law to tell us how bad we are, but the law in itself cannot melt the ice of our hearts. There was always a big bonfire on the side of Gorham's Pond where we'd come and we'd go over when we were cold and warm our hands and heat our hot chocolate. And right around that fire on the edge of the pond, the ice would begin to melt and it would begin to get soft. So much so that you had to skate around it carefully or else you'd fall through when you came toward the fire. When you come to the fire of Jesus Christ, be careful. When you come to the fire of the white, hot, holy heat of the love of Jesus for you, a sinner, be careful. Because that white, hot, holy heat will melt your heart. And it just might burn you too. Do you know what the forgiveness of Jesus does for us? It does the same thing it did for the woman and for David. It cleanses us from the inside. "Create in me a clean heart," David cried out. What can cleanse the heart of sinful people like this woman, like us. It's only the power of God's forgiveness in Christ. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. How much weeping does it take to produce enough tears to clean dirty, dusty feet? She was sobbing, wasn't she? Sobbing. Great, gushing sobs of cleansing forgiveness. And so when Jesus says to her at the end, "Go in peace," he's really saying, go into the peace. Go and live in the peace which my forgiveness gives you. The third thing we need to learn from this woman is not only that she had no illusions about who she was, not only that her illusions were melted by the acceptance and forgiveness of Jesus, but also that the greatness of her love was a response to that forgiveness. Jesus interprets this woman's expression of reverence and respect through the illustration of the moneylender. He tells Simon the Pharisee a little parable. Two people owned a fellow some money. One owed him 500 denarii. That's a denarii is one day's wage. It's a lot of money. 500 days worth of labor. Another fellow owed him only 50. He forgave both. Which one's going to love him more? Well, says Simon, full of logic, he said, well, I guess the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. And Jesus said, yes. Who's loving me more, Simon? Who's loving me more today? You? You, Simon? You didn't even give me anything to wash up with when I came in. But this woman, she brought this perfume. It's probably all she has. It's very expensive, you know, this perfume. Very costly. She probably had to sell a lot of things to get it, or maybe she had been saving it up. She brought it. The New English Bible's translation of verse 47 is perhaps very good. It says, "And so I tell you, her great love proves that her many sins have been forgiven. For when little has been forgiven, little love is shown." How does this woman show her love for Jesus? Two things. She takes an extraordinary risk first. Given her reputation, and given the scorn that she would receive from these Pharisees, and even the physical danger, it would have been understandable if she stayed home and quietly worshiped Jesus. But however much it put her at risk to come, however socially awkward it was, she did it. And so my challenge to all of us this morning is, I wonder how often social convention or fear keeps us from taking any measurable risk for Christ in our lives. One time in our church in Charlottesville, there was really for many years, most of the years I was there, there was a little boy with cerebral palsy who was brought up in a wheelchair every morning and sat in the front row. His name was Martin. And when he was a little boy, sometimes he would get so excited at being in the presence of Jesus, so excited being with God's people, so excited at the music and the songs and the hymns, so excited to be there, that he would just raise his hands and he'd go, "Wow!" And he was never embarrassed. Never embarrassed at all. At first, the people who didn't know Martin would sort of be a little embarrassed, you know. But pretty soon we got used to it. This is Martin, and this was the way he loved Jesus. And in his own way, he was taking a risk, just sort of being socially unconventional. I wonder where the risk is for some of us in our love for Christ. And then secondly, she not only takes an extraordinary risk, she also gives an extraordinary gift. As I've already said, it would be common to anoint people with oil or give them oil for their feet and their hands when they came in. Oil was very inexpensive, very commonplace. But perfume, that's another story. Very expensive, probably held around an alabaster jar around her neck. It was not only expensive, but it was the symbol, hear me now, it was the symbol of this woman's identity. Her beauty, her attractiveness to men. And what did she do with that perfume? She wanted to give it away to Jesus. We must not shrink from seeing even the financial nature of the sacrifice she was making. Again, Colson, in this book, some remarkable statistics, I must say. He's saying, in effect, that there's very little difference between Christians and those who are not Christians in their charitable habits. He says that only 25% of evangelicals tithe. He says that while 40% say faith in God is the most important thing in their lives, those who make between $50,000 and $75,000 a year give only an average of 1.5% to charity, religious or otherwise. This same group, Colson quotes Gallup, spent 12% of their income on leisure. And then Colson goes on to comment, "So while the church may seem to be experiencing a season of growth and prosperity, it is failing to move people to commitment and sacrifice." If we really understand what Jesus has done for us, then I just have to ask you, where is our sacrifice? Not just financial. Surely it includes financial sacrifice, but it includes more too. One more illustration, and then I'm done, brothers and sisters. It's a cute one, and the kids, I hope, will like it. Little girl named Martha. She had a family, lived in a small town. They didn't have a lot of money. When she went downtown one day, she saw in the window of her favorite toy store a beautiful doll. And she wanted that doll, and she went home and she asked her mom, "May I have that doll?" And her mom said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't think we can afford it just now." And so she was very sad. But you can imagine on her birthday, which was just the next week, how excited she was when the little doll came to live with her. She took the little doll everywhere. She took her to school. She took her on shopping errands. She even took her to church. And in church that Sunday, the minister was saying how much Jesus had done for us on the cross, how much he had done when he died for us on the cross, how much love he had given to us, and the story of how much love Christ had given to this little girl melted her heart. When the offering plate came around, it came down her aisle, and she put her dolly into the offering plate. A couple days later, pastor showed up at the door. She goes to the door with her mom and opens the door, and she's stunned into silence because there under the pastor's arm is, you guessed it, the little doll. And the pastor gets down and on his knees and talks to the little girl and says, "Thank you for wanting to give your dolly, but I brought her back to you. You can have her back now." "Oh, no," said the little girl. "No, I can't take her." "No, no, thank you," said the pastor, "for giving her, but it's all right. It's all right. We want you to have her back. I want you to take her back." "Oh, no, no," said the little girl. "I can't take her back. I can't. You see, I didn't give her to you." It sounds almost corny to say it, but what have you given to Jesus lately? You know, if it's not much, then maybe your heart hasn't been melted by the white, hot, holy heat of his acceptance. One of my favorite hymns is, "O Sacred Head Now Wounded," and in the third stanza of that hymn it says, "Lord, let me never, never outlive my love for thee." Make that your prayer. Get a little overwhelmed by the forgiveness of Jesus, would you? It's a pretty overwhelming thing.